As you know, Ronald Coase discovered many of the foundational ideas in modern economics. All of you know the Coase theorem, but the Coase theorem, of course, is the central idea of law and economics. Just to give the canonical statement, the Coase theorem provides that under conditions of perfect competition, private and social costs are equal. But there's also the Coase conjecture. This is the central idea of bargaining under conditions of imperfect information. Coase developed it in the context of the durable goods monopolist, and let me give you that again in its canonical form. As the period between sales becomes arbitrarily short, the price the durable goods monopolist charges becomes arbitrarily close to marginal cost. None of this is relevant for today's class. I just want you to know that there's the Coase theorem, and there's something else called the Coase conjecture, which, if you're a game theorist, turns out to be very important. Today, what I want to do is talk about another great Coasean insight, the nature of the firm. This was Ronald's senior project in college. Our senior papers lie in a closet somewhere. Ronald's won a Nobel Prize. This paper also established a methodology that served Ronald well for the last seven decades, and I should also say continues to serve him well. He's still an active scholar. It also shows clearly something that is often forgotten. Ronald's ideas, however abstract, rest ultimately on empirical foundations. So, it's the fall of 1931, and as a senior project, Ronald traveled throughout the United States to answer what seems a simple question. Why is some economic activity located inside of a firm and other economic activity organized outside of it? Adam Smith reminded us that the sensible way to make a pin requires a division of labor. But why would someone want to make a pin inside a given firm instead of having different people perform the different operations in a number of different firms? Henry Ford, for example, could have lots of different suppliers make different parts of a car, and then in his own firm merely assemble those parts. Alternatively, he could build one giant factory, have iron ore at one end, and have cars emerge at the other end. How do you choose between those two separate ways of making an automobile? What drives the difference between them? I should point out, Henry Ford actually first adopted the former method and then switched to the second. And the question you want to ask is, well, why would he do that? More generally, you have a neat paradox here. Why can't you do everything in the marketplace? In other words, why can't you have an infinite number of atomistic firms and have production and economy take place that way? Alternatively, why do you need the market at all? Why can't you have one giant firm that does everything, that makes every product, not just the Model T, but makes everything? You want to have some purchase on this question if you want to understand economic activity. If markets are so great, why can't we use them for everything? If firms are so great, why can't we use them for everything? Okay. I should also say that my particular interest in this aspect of Coase's work is that the question is especially important to someone like me who's interested in corporate reorganizations. Virtually all justifications of Chapter 11 begin with assertions to the effect that Chapter 11 is about preserving businesses. It prevents valuable assets from being sold for scrap. It saves jobs. It maintains valuable relationships between businesses and the rest of the world. Chapter 11 can fix the business and return it to financial health. Stated or not, the assumption is always that the business in Chapter 11 has value that needs to be preserved. Okay. What's that value? What's the source of that value? What is it that we're preserving? Mere hand-waving and assertions that Chapter 11 can save businesses, preserve jobs, protect assets, and so forth is insufficient. You have to have a theory of the firm to understand what it is you're preserving. Without such a theory, traditional justifications of Chapter 11 make absolutely no sense. This is why anyone who cares about corporate reorganizations necessarily cares about Coase's journey. So let's go to Coase's journey and let's ask a question that he asked on his trip to the United States. This is the relationship between General Ford and Fisher Body. Fisher started as an independent supplier to GM, but over the course of a decade, indeed in the decade just before Coase's trip to the United States, General Motors acquired Fisher, and Fisher became vertically integrated into General Motors operations. Why did we have vertical integration here? What was the nature of the firm that made it sensible at one time for Fisher to be in independent business and yet at a later time to be part of the same business as General Motors? Well, like a lot of other good scientists, Coase started with a hypothesis. The hypothesis is there is a problem here of advantage taking. To make an automobile body, which is what Fisher was doing, you need to create specialized dies for stamping metal. You need specialized equipment for stamping these pieces of metal, and these don't come particularly cheap. And once you have these dies and the specialized equipment and your Fisher, the only thing you can do is make bodies for General Motors. None of the stamped parts work for anybody else's car. Moreover, once Fisher has these dies, then General Motors can't buy the parts from anybody else. Under this kind of environment, General Motors has the ability to hold up Fisher, and Fisher has the ability to hold up General Motors. That's one of the risks, the hypothesis goes, of doing this transaction through separate people in the marketplace. That risk disappears if both are folded inside the same firm. So that's the hypothesis. And Coase, being an empiricist at heart, just a parenthetical here, Coase rhymes with Rose. There are lots of different theories about how you pronounce someone's name, but the way to start is how does that person pronounce his own name? And the answer is Coase rhymes with Rose. Coase is an empiricist at heart, and he spent a year touring the United States, visiting factories, interviewing entrepreneurs, and he realized that this particular theory of vertical integration, this advantage-taking theory, didn't hold water. It's a nice-sounding theory, but it just was wrong on the facts. Why? Well, Coase saw firsthand other large automobile suppliers, in particular A.O. Smith, which was also a large supplier to General Motors. It had even more specialized equipment that was even more specialized. It made automobile frames. This would be the what we call the chassis now, the frame that held the wheels, that held the drivetrain on top of which the car body was located. A.O. Smith made those, and it had much more specialized equipment, and it was not acquired by General Motors. Indeed, it was never acquired by General Motors and continued as an independent entity, indeed continues as an independent entity till this day. There was something about Fisher that made it different from A.O. Smith, and it wasn't the potential for advantage taking. So the crucial question that Coase is asking, one of the ideas, questions that he's going as he's going from factory to factory, is what makes A.O. Smith different from Fisher? Why does it make sense to have a firm that includes GM and Fisher, but not a firm that includes GM and A.O. Smith? This is a specific answer to a more general question, which is, why do we have firms? Why is some production done inside a firm rather than outside a firm? Why do you make your car bodies inside a firm, but not your car frames? Okay, let's start with a little bit of background on the automobile industry. By 1910, the automobile had taken the shape that it was to have for many decades, until roughly the early 70s. And as I noted before, it consisted of three principal components. There is the rigid frame to which you attached wheels, the steering mechanism. The second component was the drivetrain. This was the engine, the transmission, the drive shaft connected by a differential gear to the rear wheels. The third component was the car body. The car body was mounted on top of the automobile frame, and in the first part of the last century, the car body could be anything from an upholstered seat that was anchored on wooden floorboards to the frame, or it could be a closed body made of sheet metal. During the 19-teens, GM acquired each different type of car body from a different supplier. Fisher, as it happened, was the exclusive supplier of closed bodies. Closed bodies were the most substantial and the most expensive. Each closed body consisted of welded pieces of stamped metal that enclosed the passenger space and made the car suitable for travel in all seasons and weather. In 1919, only about 10% of the cars manufactured in this country had closed bodies. By 1927, over 85% had closed bodies. Hence, over the course of a few years, Fisher transformed itself to becoming the exclusive supplier of a major component on the vast majority of GM cars. As closed bodies became more common, General Motors' relationship with the Fisher brothers became closer. We saw, starting in 1919, GM acquired 60% of Fisher's equity and then entered into long-term contracts with the Fisher brothers. In 1926, finally, Fisher Body became formally part of General Motors and became completely integrated into it. Okay, that was the technological change that was going on. But merely saying that does not explain why it was, with this particular large supplier, General Motors needed to become vertically integrated. As already noted, it wasn't the ability to hold each other up. First, Coase discovered that there are lots of ways of solving this hold-up problem through contract. For example, GM could and did retain ownership of the dies that Fisher used to stamp the sheet metal. Fisher did not have to make substantial capital investments only for GM to turn to another supplier, because GM made the capital investment in the dies itself. Moreover, GM's ownership of the dies meant that if Fisher tried to hold it up, General Motors could simply take possession of the dies, give them to somebody else. Hence, there wasn't potential for advantage taking, so it seemed. And in any event, it wasn't as if during this period there wasn't another major supplier of a large component of a car, the automobile frame, that wasn't vertically integrated. This, again, is A.O. Smith. When you read about Coase's recollections of his journey, one of the big events for him was going and seeing A.O. Smith's factory, and the revelation there was to say, this is not part of General Motors. How can this be, given this level of asset specialization, given that it's making a component as important as Fisher Body? So what's going on? If you reject the hold-up explanation for vertical integration, what's the story that you have? And again, getting back to your central question, why do we have one firm rather than multiple firms? Okay, what exactly was going on? Why did the executives at General Motors acquire Fisher and build their own car bodies, but never acquired A.O. Smith? Why did they never decide to build automobile frames in-house, but decide they had to build car bodies in-house? The answer begins with the strategy GM's leader, Alfred Sloan, put in place when he took the helm of General Motors in the early 1920s. Sloan was convinced that crucial to GM's success was expanding the market share of Chevrolet, its lowest-priced car. Ford at this time held over half the domestic automobile market, and among low-priced cars, it dominated both the Chevrolet and all other rivals. No one could compete with the Model T in either durability or in price. I think one of the unfortunate images a lot of people have of the Model T is they think of Jed Clampett and this rickety jalopy and so forth. That's not the Model T. The Model T at the time was the most advanced car of its age. It radically transformed automobile design. When it was first produced, it was the best automobile ever made. It was an absolutely brilliant design. It was incredibly rugged. And indeed, Model Ts still run. They've been substantially surpassed technologically, but Model Ts still run. And at the time, no one could compete with it in terms of durability or price. Sloan believed that to compete effectively against the Model T, something that was crucial to GM's long-term success, he needed to have something at Chevrolet that was going to take it on in something like equal terms. His answer was something called the K model. It featured a longer body, increased legroom, an improved clutch, superior rear axle housing. He produced this car only to discover it met with but modest success. The price gap between the K model and the Model T was still too large. Model T, during this period, this is the early 20s, continued to enjoy 70% of the low-priced car market. To be successful, to survive, Sloan had to figure out a way to produce the K model, the Chevrolet, more cheaply. Central to bringing this about was Sloan's decision to hire William Knutson. William Knutson was brought in to transform Chevrolet. Knutson at the time was regarded as the best production man in the business. Knutson, just to locate this for you, was the key member of the team that designed the Model T. And he was also the member of the same team that not only designed the Model T in the first instance, but produced it for 10% less year after year after year. The magic that Henry Ford had, the thing that made Henry Ford rich beyond dreams of avarice, was that he had a team such that he could reduce the price of his car by 10% year after year after year. It wouldn't be enough in 1915 simply to copy the Model T and sell it for the same price a year later. You'd go broke doing that. Crucial to making this happen was Henry Ford's team. The best person on Henry Ford's team was William Knutson, and he was hired by Sloan to transform Chevrolet. And Knutson decided, actually, in fact, to replicate a large part of what he had done at Ford, which was to divide the production of the Chevrolet into two separate operations. First operation was the manufacturing of the basic components, the engine, the transmission, the wheels, and so forth. Secondly, was the question of assembling the parts together. Knutson was convinced that the efficient production of an automobile required a distinctive approach to each phase of the production of an automobile, manufacturing of the component part and assembly of the parts. With respect to the manufacture of the various components, Knutson insisted that these be made, if they were going to be made by General Motors, be made at one location. All the engines were made in Flint. All the axles were made in Detroit. All the transmissions were made in Toledo. Chevrolet could still use outside vendors, such as A.O. Smith or Fisher. And the problem, however, was that these outside vendors had to conform to his quality demands. Every component of the K model had to be at least as good as the components, the comparable components on the Model T. Every component had performance criteria it had to meet. They all had to outperform the Model T. And you couldn't do something like use cheap steel merely because it was cheap, especially not where the Model T used vanadium steel alloys. Again, Model T, when it was first produced, was the technologically most sophisticated car in the world. Okay, well, with respect to all these things, there were no problems with Fisher. There were no problems in terms of the quality that Fisher was producing or the price that Fisher was charging for any of its manufactured components. But this was not the big change that Knutson wanted to bring about. The big change he wanted to bring about was not with respect to the manufacture of individual components, but rather the assembly of the components. Okay, how did this work? Well, automobile assembly lines are just that. They're assembly lines. They're not manufacturing operations. Automobile components, as it turns out, are easy to ship in bulk. Finished cars aren't. Moreover, while there are economies of scale, let's say, in manufacturing an engine, you want to have all your engines made at one place, there aren't economies of scale in assembling an automobile once you have enough of them. So what Knutson decided to do was to spread out the assembly of the Chevrolet across the country into multiple different plants, ultimately a half dozen different plants. And the idea was to ship the components to these plants and have them assembled there. Automobile assembly plants are largely open floors. They are conveyors and they're pulleys that bring the pieces to the correct place, but they're not expensive to build or to replicate. Not only that, but as long as you coordinate the flow of materials to the plant, the assembly of the cars requires little in the way of skilled labor. Key is coordination. If you look at eyewitness accounts of automobile assembly plants of this era, especially Coase's, what people are marveling at is not the physical plant itself, but rather the level of organization needed to ensure that more than 1 million pounds of material comes to the plant each day and leaves each day. You need that much stuff coming and going in order to keep the things in operation. And remember, at the time when this started in earnest, you were still using horses to bring the stuff from the railway tracks. The basic philosophy of mass production is that the component parts are manufactured to very high degrees of precision. Once you do this, once your component parts are manufactured to high degrees of precision, assembling of the car itself is easy. It doesn't require any expertise. With respect to the Model T, for example, the first time the engine is ever tested is after the car has already left the assembly line, after the car is already built. You could do this because if you have high enough levels of tolerance in initial manufacture of the component, putting the car together is a breeze. The mantra of automobile assembly during this period, the mantra of Henry Ford during this period, was in mass production, there are no fitters. In the previous age of manufacturing, you'd have highly skilled technicians who take the various parts and shave them and put them together to make them work. In mass production, you didn't have those skilled people. In mass production, there are no fitters. Okay. What we had then was the use of dispersed assembly plants, low-skilled workers, bringing together these different components. Now, what did this mean for GM's relationship to Fisher? Well, what it meant was that Fisher could go on continuing to manufacture its different pieces of sheet metal anywhere it wanted to. These stamped parts, like any other automobile components, could be shipped at low costs. But assembling the pieces together into a single automobile body was a different matter altogether. Like a finished car, the completed body, this is essentially the hollow shell that goes on top of the chassis, is expensive to ship, and not only that, but it's subject to dents and other damage en route. Moreover, storing an assembled car body is expensive. You can stack pieces of sheet metal, but welded car bodies can't be stacked. Knutson insisted then that Fisher adopt the same practice for assembling its car that he instituted for assembling the different discrete components of the car. Fisher could stamp the sheet metal parts anywhere, but the bodies themselves had to be welded together at a factory adjacent to each of Chevrolet's automobile assembly plants. These plants were then connected with a system of dollies and conveyors. Now, the cost of making this change was modest. These plants were not expensive. The total capital cost of constructing all these Fisher plants was about $5 million. $5 million in a period when Chevrolet's annual operating expenses were $500 million. Again, these assembly plants for car bodies, like the assembly plants for the car itself, were just empty factory floors where you had conveyors and ropes and pulleys. There's no asset specialization at these Fisher body assembly plants. There's no holdup potential either. GM paid for these factories, not Fisher. The space was simply leased to Fisher initially. In short, with Knutson's arrival at Chevrolet, what changed was not asset-specific investment by Fisher in Chevrolet, but rather the way that Fisher conducted its day-to-day business. Knutson brought to Chevrolet a production strategy that resulted in a world in which a large part of Fisher's operations were joined on a day-to-day, hour-by-hour, minute-by-minute basis with Chevrolet's. Controls had to be put in place to ensure that each day the proper number of engines, transmissions, and frames were delivered to the automobile assembly plant. But at the same time, a corresponding assortment of stamped sheet metal, as dictated by Knutson, had to arrive at each of the various Ford body assembly plants. At the same time the components for the chassis and the drivetrain were brought together at the Chevrolet plant, the corresponding pieces of the sheet metal forming the body for that particular car had to be rolled on a dolly from the Fisher plant to the Chevrolet assembly line. Completely central to Knutson's view of production was the idea of central command and control. The center directed each of the managers as to how many cars to make each month, ensured the necessary components were shipped. Changes or alterations all had to be cleared through the center, this is through Sloan's office in Detroit. One central authority decided how many of which model would be made at each Fisher Chevrolet assembly location each month. At each location, Fisher and Chevrolet had to coordinate minute-by-minute operations. A stranger visiting any of these many auto assembly sites would not see any separation between Fisher's operations and Chevrolet's. In short, Knutson's decisions about how to produce Chevrolet required seamlessly integrating Fisher's body assembly operation into its own automobile assembly operation. To put it in cozy terms, they had to become part of the same firm. Knutson's efforts to assemble cars more cheaply captures exactly the theme of Coase's nature of the firm. Okay, let's go back to the original question. How was Fisher different from A.O. Smith? The answer is straightforward and has nothing to do with holdup or asset specificity. Completed car bodies, which Fisher supplied, were expensive to ship and hard to store. But automobile frames, which A.O. Smith supplied, can be shipped and stored easily. Efficient manufacture of cars requires the coordination of the assembly of the car body with the assembly of the rest of the car. this coordination is done more cheaply inside the firm than in the marketplace. By contrast, the assembly of the frame requires no such coordination, and it remains cheaper to acquire the frames through the market. Everything, in other words, turned on the relationship between production costs inside the firm and transaction costs outside of it. GM, and more specifically Chevrolet, reorganized its production in the 1920s with a view to capturing the same efficiencies as Ford. The organization of production, not asset specificity, is what distinguishes transaction or production inside the firm from productions outside the firm. This is the central insight that Ronald discovered on his journey. Organizing production inside the firm is costly, but so is transacting in the marketplace. The Coasean entrepreneur, in this case, Knudsen, has to figure out how to minimize both types of cost. A firm, in other words, will tend to grow until the cost of organizing activity inside the firm exceeds the cost of transacting in the marketplace. What happened again in the automobile industry during the 1920s? Well, consumer demand changed. Closed bodies became what consumers wanted, and as closed bodies became more important, the cost of one activity, car body assembly, became cheaper to do inside a firm. It's cheaper to get two assembly lines to run in sync with each other when they are under the control of the same manager than when produced independently in the marketplace. Again, this is the central message of Coase's scholarship again and again. Transaction costs are everything. If you want to minimize transaction costs, it turns out, given the change in consumer demand, given the technology of automobiles at the time, the way to minimize costs was to bring this activity inside the firm. Why? Because production costs inside the firm was cheaper than transacting in the marketplace. Okay, that was Coase's journey. What do you learn about Chapter 11 when you take this message to heart? Well, in fact, it's a pretty sobering message. If firms are about organizing production, then we can't assume that a particular business necessarily has value as a going concern. If all we're doing is organizing production, we not have specialized assets, but all we're doing is organizing production, then what's the reason for keeping a particular business intact? Indeed, as communication costs, transportation costs, and contracting costs drop, it becomes easier to produce goods without creating a traditional business, or for there to be great value in preserving one. The ability to outsource has left even large-scale manufacturers less dependent on having their own plant and equipment. To give one example, most of Boeing's 787 Dreamliner is being built by someone other than Boeing. Indeed, manufacturers in Japan are building more than a third of the 787. And the component parts are being sent to Seattle. And what's Boeing principally doing in Seattle with the 787? It's assembling. Human capital today is increasingly industry-specific, not firm-specific. Even in the most high-tech sector of the economy, the place where the skills of the workers tend to loom the largest, we see high levels of worker mobility. Worker mobility, again, has increased over the last several decades, and workers are now more mobile because the skills they acquire at one business are readily transferable to another in the same industry. Okay, now, I'm not saying there are no sources of going concern value. I'm not saying that organization of production from the start is costless or that firms in Chapter 11 can have no value as a going concern. I'm simply saying you have to be skeptical. Large businesses do have thousands of employees. Each employee has multiple relationships with each other and with the business's many suppliers and customers. But are these relationships we should move heaven and earth to preserve when the firm is in Chapter 11? For this to be the case, we must establish both that the business's relationships are costly to replicate and the business itself is sound. Neither is likely to be true for the large businesses that find themselves in Chapter 11 today. Let me give several examples. Consider Global Crossing, one of the largest corporations ever to go through Chapter 11. Global Crossing is emblematic of Chapter 11's past and its future. If you want to think of Chapter 11's past, think of the large giant railroads at the end of the 19th century. These required huge investments of capital, and the investments went into creating iron rails over narrow strips of land that extended for thousands of miles. This is a world in which you can't take the left-hand rail and separate it from the right-hand rail. It's not very coherent to talk about a railroad being owned by multiple people. Now, of course, you can have the same set of tracks being owned by multiple people. The Northern Pacific and the Central Pacific is a good example of that. Nevertheless, you think of one railroad, one set of tracks connecting Chicago and New York as being one firm. You don't want to separate it, and you've got this huge capital cost. It doesn't cost that much to run the railroad, but you make a huge investment at the outset. In that kind of a universe, there's a very powerful reason for making sure you keep these assets together. You have asset-specific investment, and to preserve the value of this asset-specific investment, you need to keep this railroad intact. But if you think about it, this conception of why it was we needed to preserve the railroads at the end of the 19th century, and I should say most of them were insolvent at the time. There was massive overbuilding in the industry. This rationale does not apply to the Coasean firm. So compare the large railroads with the counterpart that we see most recently. The most recent one, as I say, is Global Crossing. Global Crossing was formed in 1997, and it was to close one of the last gaps in the internet. The telecommunications cables beneath the oceans were too small, or thought to be too small, to accommodate the expected explosion in internet use outside of North America. In 1997, those outside North America accounted only for 20% of internet use. By 2000, they would account for almost half. To take advantage of this change, Global Crossing laid a transatlantic cable within 10 months and embarked upon ambitious plans to create a global fiber network. The idea is they would have a global network of fiber optic cable that would circle the world. They would own this particular network in the same way that one railroad would own the track between New York and Chicago. It reached $1 billion in revenues within its first 20 months, and it soon had market capitalization larger than that of General Motors. Global Crossing continued to invest billions in creating the first fiber optic network across the world's oceans. Global Crossing's fall, however, was as swift as its rise. Competitors appeared, internet traffic grew, yes, but not at the rate expected. It was expected to double every 3 months. It only doubled every year. That's a lot of growth, but it's not what people expected. Moreover, there was technological innovation that allowed 100 times as much information to be pushed through the same piece of cable. As a result, there was massive overcapacity, and Global Crossing's revenue dropped. Indeed, it barely paid its operating expenses, not something we saw with the railroads. Its stock price collapsed. Global Crossing is now in Chapter 11, and the question you want to ask is Global Crossing worth preserving as a going concern? Well, it's not the same as a railroad. Of course, these assets are still valuable, but no one's talking about destroying the assets. All we're talking about is, do we need to keep these assets together inside the same firm? Not clear they should be. Communications networks can be formed easily through contract. As long as these contracting costs are low, and they are, Global Crossing's ability to offer you a direct connection between Tokyo and London is not worth that much. A pulse of light can be transferred between multiple carriers much more easily than rail freight. A detour of 1,000 miles is irrelevant. A route that's twice as long doesn't matter. It matters when you're moving wheat or coal. It doesn't matter when you're moving light. The value of what's being preserved by keeping a business like Global Crossing intact is much smaller than the case of railroads. Selling off these individual cables is not that big a deal. If you have a Coasean conception of a firm, you have to worry about whether or not this idea that Chapter 11 should preserve going concern value has a lot of oomph associated with it. The organization of production, remember, is what matters, and organizing production within a firm may simply not be that costly. Nothing about Coase's theory of the firm requires that relationships that constitute a firm be costly to replicate or to create in the first instance. Indeed, we can go beyond that. Coase's conception of the firm tells us that unless these costs are low, production won't even take place within the firm at all. As transaction costs go down, the upper bound on the value of the relationships of the firm go down as well, along with its value as a going concern. Let me give one more example. This is the example of Pilotex. Pilotex, you might know, not know by manufacturing name, but is the manufacturer or was the manufacturer of Cannon and Royal Velvet towels, Fieldcrest sheets and pillows. Does that name register with any of you? Okay. They had factories, many, many factories. They spent millions building these factories. They had thousands of employees, and they had all sorts of relationships that made this business work. Unfortunately, notwithstanding the expense of building these factories and hiring these employees and training these employees, these have no value in a world in which these towels, sheets, and pillows can be made for less offshore. Pilotex entered Chapter 11, and it was a two-year-long effort to mediate the relationships among employees, suppliers, and others. It brought together diverse interests, and a plan emerged that gave the business its best chance going forward. But the forces work there that the best intention can't stop. In the end, there was nothing Chapter 11 could do to save Pilotex. Why? It had no value as a going concern. For better or for worse, the role that Chapter 11 can play in today's economy has little or nothing to do with what was happening in the railroad cases. And when you look at Chapter 11 through a Coasean lens, you see that many distressed firms have no value as a going concern. The business is organizing production, and this production may not be that well organized, and even if it is, it can be replicated at low cost. Chapter 11, seen through this rather grim Coasean lens, is quite different. It's a perspective that's undeniably been missing in the scholarship. Put differently, too many bankruptcy scholars for too long have yet to realize something that Coase understood in college. To do what they do, you need a theory of the firm. These are a group of people who need to take a journey and don't even know it yet. Now, this is the uneasy lesson of Coase's nature of the firm for those who care about corporate reorganizations. But there is, I should say, a happier and more more general lesson, and one that I think is decidedly upbeat. It's not so much that Ronald asked a question of astonishing difficulty. It's not so much that Ronald used incredibly complicated mathematics. It's rather that he figured out an interesting question and embarked on an extremely interesting journey. This is the magic that you see in all of his work, and it's something that none of us can do, but at least we can aspire to replicate, if only on a small scale. So I'd recommend that you realize that ideas don't come out of the blue. They frequently require a journey, and you need to venture forth. So read Coase, read Sunstein, Posner, Nussbaum, Epstein, Stone and Curry, and then start your own journey. Thank you very much. That's hard. It's qualified in the following respect. When I was talking about the details of production in the automobile industry, I was focusing on its early years, 19 teens and 20. It's now somewhat different. And it's somewhat different because you do have more asset specialization now than you did then. Just to give an example, in 1913, this is when the year that Henry Ford discovered the assembly line, his total capital costs all in were less than $10 million. $10 million is the amount of money he had to pay, he paid to institute his $5 a day plan. The automobile industry now does have very substantial capital costs. So it's harder. But I think the thing that's particularly difficult is if they go in, an event that I do not regard as that unlikely, A.O. Smith, by the way, is now in Chapter 11. If they go in, the issue is not going to be chopping them up and selling them for kindling. I mean, no one's talking about doing that. But the question is, is there real value in keeping them together as GM, as Ford, as one firm? One has to be skeptical about that. One has to be skeptical about it precisely because you can produce these cars and not have them all under one roof. It's just not necessary. Yes?
So really, the thesis is that you can have, not because of bankruptcy, but I guess in Chapter 11, you can kind of kind of do what they did with AT&T and at that trust session, and break it up and say, well, you're going to, we're going to involve one big company, and then, but now you can, you're going to have a separate company for the body and separate company for the frame.
I think I would put it slightly differently. I agree. I think I'd put it slightly differently, which is when you're talking about large public companies where there is the separation of management and control, we're not worried about the single owner, manager, entrepreneur where you can't tell the dancer from the dance, but you're talking about a large corporation. I think the short answer is we don't have anything to fear from selling off the assets to the highest bidder. And if it turns out that we can get more for the component parts than for the business as a whole, we don't have to say, well, gee, we should keep that from happening somehow. There's just much less to fear there. Yes?
I guess it seems to me that the application of Coase's theorem or the Coase's journey is easier in cases or in firms which are providing manufactured goods or which are using a lot of infrastructure, I guess like Global Crossing, than with firms which are might be much more service-oriented. And
why?
I wonder, well, I mean, that's sort of kind of my gut-level intuition. I wonder, is that mistaken? Is it just it's...
Oh, no, I think it's even harder.
Okay.
Because if you don't have specialized assets, what exactly do you have? And it may be that you have incredibly valuable relationships, but you have to ask, do those require a particular firm? If, for example, to give another example from the automobile industry, if you look at Henry Ford and ask, okay, what made Henry Ford rich? I mean, fantastically rich, unbelievably rich. It wasn't the assets of the Ford Motor Company. Were it the loyal, dedicated employees? Let's say we're looking at 1913. Was it the loyal, dedicated employees of the Ford Motor Company? Well, he had a turnover rate of 380% in 1913. What was really valuable? What was really valuable were people like Knudsen. And the fact that Henry Ford found Knudsen and brought him onto his team and used Knudsen to help him design the Model T. And the value that Ford had was the fact that he had people like Knudsen on his team designing the Model T. And the question you need to ask is, well, gee, when you assemble a team like that, isn't it sort of important, you know, that's sort of the service firm at large, that they be inside the same firm? Knudsen didn't work for Henry Ford when he designed the Model T. He worked for an independent contractor. I think teams really matter. I think teams are really important. I think when you look at great teams that have existed over long periods of time where the character and the culture remains the same, that's important, but you can't confuse the team with the firm. Among other things, how costly is it to replicate the firm if what it consists of is that team of individuals who aren't owned by the firm? You can just blow up the entire firm, and the people get together the next day and say, okay, let's start XYZ Corporation all over again. Yes?
When you described why the engine should be built all at once,
uh-huh.
You used the term economies of scale.
Right.
I guess I have two questions. That seems like economies of scope, maybe, would be maybe part of it, and then the second part would be isn't that sort of a conclusion? Isn't that what a
lot of... all I meant was, in saying this, and again, this is one of the reasons you have to be really careful about speaking this as economic truth as opposed to simply saying, this is the choice made by one person in the industry at one time. Knudsen thought that the most efficient way to... let me not use economies of scale. He thought that the cheapest way to produce Chevrolet's engines was to produce them all in one place. Okay. Now, why did he think that? Well, he thought that because that's what Ford did. Okay. Why did Ford do it that way? Because Knudsen wanted to do it that way at Ford. So you don't have an experiment. I mean, one of the things we forget about modern capitalism is it's an experiment that's really only just started to run. And this particular, you know, is it the case that it's more efficient to produce all your, that at the time it was more efficient to produce all the engines in one place when you're making millions of cars? Well, Knudsen thought so. Was he right? Well, we don't know. Did anybody else think so? Well, nobody else had to make the decision. So I'm not weighing too heavily on the idea that I didn't want to suggest that was the way to do it as much as that's the way he thought was the way to do it. And again, the Coasean entrepreneur is someone that Coase believes makes these decisions. And of course, in a market economy, if you run the experiment long enough, if Knutson is wrong, then in competition, his firms will fail and others will succeed. Yes?
How does United fit into the analysis?
I think United is an interesting case, but one in which I would say that I this is my take on United. First of all, United is its goods were slightly less fungible than you might have thought. TWA's airplanes were seamlessly acquired by American. United, in part because of its long relationship with Boeing, had much more customization of its airplanes than other large aircraft manufacturers. Now, doing that was stupid, but given they've done it, you're sort of stuck with it. So you can't take a United 757 and simply repaint it and have American fly it because you have different avionics, different configuration, you have to train different pilots. And that lowers the value of United, but that's not, but you still have to take the hand that you're dealt. Okay. I am willing to believe that United probably does have some value as a going concern. And I'm willing to infer that because the creditors of United want to keep it together. And they found themselves in front of a bankruptcy judge who basically, if the creditors of United had come in arm in arm and said, look, Judge, this firm is not worth keeping intact. It would not have been like an Eastern, where the judge just thought it was good for the American people to have Eastern Airlines fund. Judge Weedoff basically would say, look, it's your firm. It's your choice. I'm not saying you would do it casually, but Judge Weedoff is a good guy, graduate of this law school, I should point out, and an all-round good, astute person. And you know, his attitude is, look, the creditors want me to try to keep the firm together. That's what I'm going to do. But if they think the firm should be liquidated, well, it's their firm, not my firm. So there's some value as a going concern. But how large is that value? It's skeptical about how large it is. If you actually look at the imputed value of the aircraft, which don't depreciate in value very very much, the imputed value of the aircraft is actually not far off from the price that people associate with the firm as a whole. Yes?
As far as the United concern, isn't it that they didn't really own much of it? A lot of it was just leases, correct? I mean, how did that...
Yes, but what they're doing is they're burning through tens of millions of dollars of operating losses and of and lawyer's fees and so forth. And the point is they're willing to make those expenditures in order to, and rather than all the other, whatever is left after all the leases and so forth is gone, that money was being consumed during the bankruptcy, and that's money that would otherwise go to the creditors. And the creditors basically said, we'd rather spend the money on Jamie Sprayreagan than simply park all these planes in the desert. And that's the choice that's being made. Yes?
Just a more general question about the airline industry. So you have these gigantic players that are all in trouble now and low-cost providers. And I was just wondering, what is the advantage of having the gigantic player infrastructure? Is that worth preserving?
Well, first, it may not be worth preserving. There's no necessary magic to it, but I think what you have to understand about the airline industry is that there are multiple different kinds of business. Southwest is not in the same business as United. Southwest is in the business of flying you from point A to point B very cheaply. United is in the business of taking you from anywhere in the world to any other place in the world through a hub and spoke system. That hub and spoke system is, in terms of the flying public, incredible. I mean, you can wake up in Cedar Rapids and go to bed in Tokyo, and to be able to go point to point like that, or if you're blessed to live in Chicago, you can get almost go to O'Hare and step out, go into O'Hare and then step out almost anywhere in the world, and with very quickly with very few connections and so forth. Running that kind of large network hub and spoke system is a different kind of business. The basic economic problem United faces at the moment is how many of those networks will our economy support? If the answer is one, then United's in a lot of trouble. If the answer is two or three or four, then United has a pretty good chance. We don't know if United's business model will succeed, but you should understand that its business is different from Southwest's business. It's not better or worse, it's just different. Yes?
Do you think that, totally different question. Do you think the differences in insolvency laws between different countries reflect a different understanding of the economics behind insolvency or political?
Well, it's somewhat complicated because in this country our insolvency laws have a really complicated and mixed tradition. It's always been the case that we've been a debtor nation, and we've also had a long tradition of stiffing creditors, especially Europeans who were foolish enough to lend us money. And that tradition makes us somewhat different. I think it's also the case that if you want to talk in more nobler terms about why our law is nice, everybody else's law is nice, and so forth, is that our economy developed at a different point. In other words, we had these giant railroads long before other countries had giant railroads, or at least private enterprises of comparable scope. And our railroads, when they were developed initially, had capital structures that were a mess. And if you look at the equity receivership tradition in this country, which I think is actually largely a sensible one, and Chapter 11, which I regard as largely sensible, derives from that, it's a tradition in which you needed the law of equity receiverships, the ancestor of Chapter 11, because problems came along that people just hadn't anticipated. When, as an economy develops, there's less pressure to do that. I would also say that Chapter 11 today differs from reorganization regimes in other countries much less than people think it does. Chapter 11 today, people should understand, with respect to large firms, is largely about doing two things. Selling firms as going concerns and implementing pre-negotiated deals. Again, this is a very cozy idea that you need to do this stuff inside the firm. It can be done in the market. Well, if transaction costs are low enough, you can do it in the market. In the late 19th century, you couldn't sell the assets of a giant railroad in the market to the highest bidder, because you couldn't get those kinds of aggregations of capital. You could do it today. You couldn't communicate among the bondholders and so forth as easily then as you can do now. Given that you can do it now, what's happened is Chapter 11 has morphed into this procedure that allows the ready sale of companies and the implementation of pre-existing plans at relatively low cost. Obviously, if you look at the amount of money these bankruptcy lawyers are making, it's a lot. But if you look at it relative to the cost of a merger and acquisition transaction, which is parallel to it, about the same, the costs are roughly comparable. And so what Chapter 11 today is doing in practice is something that seems to make a lot of sense. The difficulty that a lot of the traditional bankruptcy scholars have is that they wish Chapter 11 were doing something else. They want the good old days. And yet they can't really explain, given COES, why they want the good old days or what was so good about them. Or to the extent there's anything good about them, why they're still good.